From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South.
I tried to be quiet, but before much time passed, I spoke out loudly to the class. That was the meanest thing I've ever seen.
You always talk about others cheating, as she reached over and picked up the blank tile that Aunt Vi had just played. Mom picked up the blank and flipped it over. It wasn't blank after all.
I knew what I had to do. I assembled all 20 printed pages, and I dialed his number. Hey, you got a minute?
Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
I write it all down just so eyes don't forget. Is this blood still here in my veins? Is this blood still here in my veins? There's blood still here in my veins. Oh,
how's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland Angel and Nick Devlin? Y'all like the music? Amy Garland has been playing music since she was 9 years old and writing songs as soon as she learned two chords. Her weekly radio show, Back Roads, can be heard on KABF FM 88.3 in Central Arkansas, and you can find out more about her and the upcoming release of her third album on Facebook at Amy Garland Music. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our writers are all caught up in the tangled web of deception as they struggle to hold on to what is honest and true. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Denise Stafford is playing a game when suddenly someone is caught cheating. And we'll end the night with Leslie Hitt as she is blindsided by an email she was never meant to read. But let's start the night with Jill Duvall as a teacher deceives a room full of students and Jill makes her move in Paper Airplanes.
Our eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Thompson, stared us down and then asked for anyone who had participated in the partying while she stepped out of our classroom to stand up and confess their crime. Not a soul moved an inch or spoke a sound. Miss Thompson stared and stared, occasionally saying, "I know someone in this room will admit to their crimes." Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed Tracy Smith starting to fidget. She was a shy girl, never even got in trouble, and probably giggled once during the mayhem. I closed my eyes and prayed that Tracy would stay seated. I suspected she was vulnerable to falling for Mrs. Thompson's pressure. I'd seen that same sort of pressure on Sunday mornings at the First Baptist Church. If the singing of Just As I Am went on long enough, someone would finally step out and get saved. Mrs. Thompson's reputation was for being mean and for preferring boys, but I was certain I could win her over at the start of eighth grade. Her hair was bright red and hairsprayed into this whirlwind hairdo that sat on the top of her head. The first time I laid eyes on her, I thought she was pretty, but after you met her, she quickly got ugly. Often, she would leave the room while we were supposed to be working on our math problem worksheets. As soon as she exited, multiple students would get up to sharpen a pencil, throw something away, or walk around the room. On this particular day when she left, students started chasing each other around the perimeter of the classroom, and almost everyone was talking and laughing to whoever was sitting next to their row. When Mrs. Thompson came back in, there were paper airplanes flying through the air. Three girls were leading cheers, and several boys were running around chasing each other. Eighth graders are fast on their feet, and we all returned to our seats within seconds, but we knew we'd been caught. Sure enough, Tracy raised her hand. Miss Thompson asked her to stand up and started asking questions. Did you behave while I was out of the classroom? No, ma'am. Did you work on your math sheets while I was gone? No, ma'am. What were you supposed to do while I was out of the classroom? Tracy answered, stay quiet and work on our math sheets. That's right. So you understand why you're in trouble. Yes, ma'am, Tracy agreed. Then Mrs. Thompson told her to go in the hallway. I remember watching Tracy walk to the front of the row, and I felt so bad for her because she had on a short plaid ruffle skirt. The paddling sound could be heard within seconds of them leaving the room, but it didn't go by fast. Mrs. Thompson must have pulled back, walloped Tracy hard, and then waited a second to hit her again. Tracy got 10 licks that afternoon, and I felt sicker and sicker with each hit. It wasn't because the rest of us hadn't confessed. It was a setup to confess, and I felt fine about avoiding that. What made me sick was realizing an adult could be that mean and cruel. Up to that point, I thought grown-ups were better versions of kids. They knew more, could ride a bike faster, throw a ball further, and were allowed to drive cars. But this grown-up, this Mrs. Thompson, was willing to torture a young girl just to show us she could. When Tracy came back in, she was crying and covering the backs of her thighs with her hands. The classroom stayed quiet. Mrs. Thompson told us to keep on working on our math sheets until the bell rang. I tried to be quiet, but before much time passed, I spoke out loudly to the class. That was the meanest thing I've ever seen. I looked straight at Miss Thompson. Oh, really? She asked. You thought that was mean? Yes, ma'am. You beat the most innocent one in our class when you knew all of us were guilty. To the principal's office you go. She pointed toward the door. I was hoping she'd let me go on to the office by myself, but she grabbed my collar and walked me down the hall. She told a made-up story to Mr. Lewis, accusing Tracy of being the ringleader of the whole mess and me popping off, talking back, and being insubordinate. I wasn't exactly sure what insubordinate meant, but it didn't sound good. Mr. Lewis said he would take care of it and walked out with Miss Thompson, leaving me to sit and worry about what was coming next. He had a big wooden paddle hanging right in the middle of the wall to his desk. I could hear him laughing and talking with Mrs. Thompson, but he all got all quiet when he came back into his office. He had a piece of paper in his hand and dialed the phone number written down on it. Mr. Duval, Mr. Lewis asked my dad. My stomach started hurting really bad now. Your daughter Jill is here in my office and you need to come down to the school right away. Mr. Lewis hung up the phone and told me to sit still and wait until my father arrived. Now, I had one of the nicest dads in the world, but I figured he might be upset having to come and get me in the middle of his work day. But he didn't look mad when he walked in. "Hey, sugar," he said, and sat down in the chair to my left. Mr. Lewis then told my dad another new version of the day's events, in which Tracy, the girl who got paddled, was an outgoing, antisocial criminal type who could only be controlled by paddling. Then he moved on to me. I remember he used that insubordinate word again and talking back and disrespecting Mrs. Thompson, who, he said, has to be able to run her classroom. My dad listened to every word he said, never asked one question. Mr. Lewis finished by saying the severity of my behaviors would result in suspension for 3 days. I knew I was sunk. But then my dad turned to me and said, "Now it's your turn. What's your story?" I blurted out everything. The paper airplanes flying overhead, the chases going on, the girls leading cheers. I admitted I'd been laughing and talking my head off because the boy next to me was making pig faces and oinking real good. Somewhere in the part where Tracy confesses and gets taken out of the room, I started crying. I told him how long it took Miss Thompson to give 10 licks and how Tracy was crying and holding her thighs when she walked back in. Then I told him word for word what I said to Miss Thompson and how I hadn't talked back. I'd only told her she was wrong. My dad sat for a minute, still turned toward me, winked, and faced the principal. He spoke quietly and slowly as he asked Mr. Lewis if he still felt I should be suspended. Mr. Lewis looked uncomfortable, but nodded his head yes. "Well," my dad said, "we have a little problem." Dad then asked me to leave the room, and I waited out in the secretary's office. I could hear voices, but not the words that were said. All I know is when Dad came out, he was grinning and gave me a big hug. We didn't talk much on the way home. Dad gave me some pep talk about how having a strong personality can be a blessing and a curse. I had no clue what he meant, but he was happy, and I got to miss the last few hours of school. The next day, when I walked into Mrs. Thompson's classroom, she caught my eye, nodded, and smiled one of those big Southern beauty contest smiles. Then I noticed when Tracy came in, she smiled at her too. I thought I was dreaming. The rest of that class and the rest of the semester, she still said mean things to everybody else, but to me and Tracy, she was as sweet as holiday pie. I gathered my books to leave that day and wondered what in the Sam Hill my dad had said behind that closed principal's door. But somewhere in the hallway in the rush of kids, I realized that it didn't really matter what he said. What mattered is that I had a dad who showed up, believed me and Tracy Smith, and backed me up. I figured that was all I needed to know.
Jill Duvall lives in Russellville, Arkansas, and tries to write every day. She recently published a mystery ebook, Premeditated Blues, and is busy working on the second installment. In our next story, Denise Stafford discovers that it's not all fun and games as fingers start pointing in Saving Grace.
There I was, sitting at my Aunt Vi's table playing Scrabble with my mom and Aunt Vi, smoke from their cigarettes billowing above our heads. My sister and cousin Derek, both 4 years old, were running all over the house playing, so my aunt's nerves were rattled to begin with. It was Aunt Vi's turn, and she was puffing her cigarette and thinking about a word. We were down to just a few tiles, and she was trying to go out. The person that used all the letters and went out won the game. And if you don't know, there are only 2 blank tiles in a Scrabble game. The winner got to count the points of the tiles from the other players, and Aunt Vi was determined to win. Mom was sitting there, puffing on her cigarette and urging Vi on. We were all sipping on ice-cold sweet tea. Aunt Vi puffed her smoke, snubbed out her cigarette, and took a sip of tea. She laid out her tiles to spell a word. She had a smirk on her face as she announced that she had used all of her tiles. I began counting my points when Mom said, "Hold on, you always talk about others cheating," as she reached over and picked up the blank tile that Aunt Vi had just played in her winning hand. Mom picked up the blank and flipped it over. It wasn't blank after all. 3 years earlier, our world was turned upside down when my older brother drowned while on a trip with some friends. We were still reeling from the death of my Gram, Mom's mom. She passed away while my mom was pregnant with my sister. And during that time, my Aunt Viola was saving grace for my sister, Mom, and me. Big Butt Bertha was a name the cousins and I used when aggravating Aunt Vi. She wasn't Big Butt Bertha during this sad time. She was the saving grace for the whole family. Her house provided that emotional escape that we all desperately needed. My dad was captain of a riverboat, which took him away from the home for a month or more at a time. When he was gone, Mom said she felt like the walls were closing in on her. The loss of her mom and son was a lot for her to deal with. Aunt Vi was there to pull her out of her depression. She pulled all of us out of our sadness. So we would go to Aunt Vi's house every weekend. We would go down on Saturday morning and spend the day, sometimes into the wee hours of morning. We would always end up around the dining room table playing games. Aunt Vi had a built-in china cabinet in her dining room where she stored the games. And there was just about every kind of game you could imagine. But our favorites were cards, rummy cube, and Scrabble. A crystal chandelier hung above the dining room table, and I would look at it and imagine the crystals as being huge diamonds. Aunt Vi was a funny lady. She would argue with anyone. She would get huffy in a second if she thought someone was cheating in a game. Mom always said it was because she didn't like to lose and wasn't any good at cheating. And then came the day with the flipped over Scrabble tile. With egg on her face, Aunt Vi picked up her tiles and returned them to the tray. She snatched up another cigarette and lit it while I was taking my turn. I played a word, using all of my tiles and going out. I won! Aunt Vi pushed herself back from the table with enough force to move the tiles off the table. "I'm not playing with Denise anymore," she proclaimed in her snarly way. Mom giggled. "Why not? Because you got caught cheating?" "No," Vi replied, "because she always cheats and never gets caught. I made a mistake. I thought the tile was blank." Mom, still snickering, said, "Okay, oh, Vi. You've never been able to cheat. You're not any good at it. Don't be a sore loser." Aunt Vi huffed off to the den and sat on her spot on the couch. Mom told us girls to get ready to go home. She said, "Vi needs some time to cool off." All the time, Mom had a grin on her face, and Vi was pouting. Needless to say, that was the end of our game that Saturday evening. And if you're wondering, I don't cheat at games. Aunt Vi just always said I did.
Denise Stafford lives in Wynn, Arkansas with her husband and two sons. She teaches at Wynn High School and is currently working on her educational specialist degree at Arkansas State University in Jonesboro. In our final story of the night, Leslie Hitt stumbles upon a deception and there's no turning back in The Girl with the Wedding Ring Tattoo.
Few moments in life are as painful yet exquisite as this one. My rational brain could formulate that sentence. My rational brain could step back and watch like a helium-filled bystander. I'm actually proud that while my life was imploding, my rational brain recognized the potential engorged in that moment for holding so many cards to important life decisions for several people and for a great, funny, sad, hell of a good story. I like to think I giggled, elbowed my other self, and said, "Watch this." And now, in this corner, standing in a puddle of their own urine, sobbing hysterically and blowing a snot bubble is my other self, the one who just wanted to suck their thumb in the fetal position because they didn't know what to do with their hands and dying was not an option. So yeah, I was looking at his email, but not for this. He told me he had written his father about how he'd been feeling lately as an apology for being a person I had never met before and certainly would not have married. Before I went into his office, I took a moment to realize that whatever he had told his father might really hurt me to read and that I needed to prepare myself for that chance. So inadvertently, and because I can't figure out how to run a Mac anyway, I started with the oldest emails and read forward. The first one I found that made me furrow my brow and think, this is a little inappropriate, was a stupid, dirty little joke. I spent 10 minutes trying to figure out how to print it off so I could talk to him about it when he got home. Along the lines of, I know you're not used to having employees, and I'm not trying to tell you how to run your business, but you have to be careful of what you say. Sexual harassment isn't just for Demi Moore and Michael Douglas anymore. And in the same tone of voice, I would have assigned hootie duties to the pledge class that was late for sorority-mandated study hall in 1983. And then there was another email, and another one, then so many more, and one ended with, I'm so glad you were in my life. The mad tears burst out of me, and I fell belly first on the monkey bars. I know I made a sound because the beagle ceased licking the floor to stare at me, one ear wrong side out from his hurry. So I printed those out too. Yet I couldn't stop reading. Who could really? I mean, really, I'd like to know who could walk away from that. A trip was planned to New Orleans, to a conference I was encouraging him to attend to get his creative juices flowing again. A pregnant pause in time, then head first to the bottom of the swimming pool. He spoke about the fun they would have in town, in the hotel, just being together, and that he loved her. Thank goodness my son, his stepson, was not home. At 17, I don't know if there's enough therapy in the world to have gotten him through seeing me like that. I screamed, loud, guttural, and open-mouthed, and stood up too fast, crashing the chair to the floor. I crammed my hands into my hair toward my face and pulled as hard as I could, feeling a cold, generous sweat already there. I lumbered to the bathroom just in time, then laid my head on the old green tile. I'm a very practical person. I make lists. I get things done. I remember being outraged at the amount of work I had just been given. The list: dissolve a marriage, procure housing, move a child, dog, cat, myself, and tell my parents. Oh God, tell my parents. I felt so sorry for them to have to go through a divorce with me again. My eyes were swelling shut, and then complete quiet, dead calm. Enter the painful yet exquisite moment. I knew what I had to do. I assembled all 20 printed pages and I dialed his number. Me, in an upbeat tone. Hey, you got a minute? Him. Sure, babe, how are you? Me. Oh, I'm good. Good. Hey, I want to read you something. Him. Oh, did you write something new? Awesome. Here, let me step outside so I can hear you better. Me. Well, it's not really new, but okay. Shuffling of papers. Okay, here you go. I can't wait to be with you in New Orleans, lying on the bed with your hair across my chest, watching a movie. Him. Crickets. The denials, the apologies, the weeping, the I'm coming home right now. I won't bore you with the cliches. I was bored with the cliches. So I convinced him not to come home right then, that if he did, it would force me to move in the middle of the night. And I had the child, the dog, the cat to muster. I convinced him we should go to therapy. And believe it or not, that's where it got even sadder. I've heard that men use fewer words than women every day. Somewhere along the way, I became a man. My words get used up, and I can't stand to speak or hear any more of them. It is a physical response. Another reason on my long list of reasons why I don't carry a handgun. After years of trying to break through the sulking, I couldn't shut him up. Let me tell you what I think. What do I want? Well, let me tell you. My goals include, dude, the kid down the street knows what you think. The neighbor's cocker spaniel knows what you want, as well as your short and long-term goals. He gushed and he gushed, and all I could think was, please, just shut up. The part about accepting our differences? Sorry, no. The part about me being an indoor fashion girl and he being an outdoors rugged guy that was in our wedding vows? May no. Exit stage left and watch out for the trap door. Oops, sorry. Here's another list. Things I don't regret having done in this horrible situation. Number one, making that phone call. Number two, writing this email. Hi, insert name here. It's Leslie. Surprise! You know, New Orleans does sound incredible with my husband. Just to walk through the city holding hands, not just for what he wants to do, but just to be together. But alas, others might find out. Let's get one thing straight. You didn't marry me, and you owe me nothing but a house key. Because did I mention it was a home office? And the knowledge that as long as I still live here, you won't be visiting. Is this the bad thing you were afraid would happen if I found out? Number three, telling her boyfriend. Okay, I regret the stalking activities I had to do to find his email address. But that's it. Email number two and the final one. Hey, insert name here. Sorry if my email and subsequent phone calls make you a little uncomfortable, as you should be. Word of advice. The next time you want to play with someone else's husband, man up and answer your phone. Here's the last list, the superficial regrets. Number one. A hasty order for cargo pants from Eddie Bauer. I mean, really, who was I trying to kid? Somebody types need to just walk away. However brief the moment, I am ashamed that I ever wanted to be like her. Number two, the time and tears shed while trying to work it out. See, I mourned my other husbands while we were together. Every time something would happen, I would lose a little feeling until there was just nothing left. And at the end, it was just peaceful for me. But this time, I had been robbed of this twisted little coping method. And that made me really, really mad. Number three, I never found the email to his dad, the one thing I was looking for. Number four, the wedding ring tattoo. Now, there's a real conundrum, which I struggle with almost daily. I've toyed with turning it into something else, music notes, ivy, flowers. Laser removal is too expensive. It costs $40 to put it on and $2,000 to take it off. I don't think so, Scooter. Maybe I'll just use a Sharpie on it every day as a word mood ring. Pensive. Punchy, snarky. If you can read this, get out of my personal space. Or maybe I'll just leave it to show that at one point in my life, I loved someone so much that I etched my skin as our wedding ring, signifying that we would be together in something I used to like to call forever. So I still have them, all 20-some-odd pages. I'm planning a burning party with really cool invitations. Holy smokes, let's light up some heartache. Or Leslie, the girl who plays with fire, tomorrow. I'll invite my friends to bring over something that they too need to burn, over pine and eucalyptus branches, smudged with smoking sage leaves, drinking sweet potato queen margaritas, with impromptu incantations thrown in for fun. We can roast something yummy and decadent on top, and I can celebrate a life that, although slid into home plate, limping and bleeding, is finally all mine, a true moment to savor.
Leslie Hitt lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas, where she works for UAMS Northwest. Her background includes accounting, video production, mall leasing, and higher education. She is currently working on a sitcom screenplay about the shopping mall world, as well as continuing to write about a life that is too rich to be fiction. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.